Yes, we are still in the book of Revelation. If you have been with us the last few months, we have been slowly working our way through this. If you're new with us, we've spent the last 3 or 4 months in this final book of the Bible, and I'm going to say a little bit more about that in a moment. But there is an end in sight. We can see that as we're rolling along in the book of Revelation, that the end is coming near. We are going to spend the rest of September looking at the last few chapters, chapters 21 and 22, of this vision of the new heaven and the new earth, of what God has in store for us and what this means for us now. And then I'm excited, I want to preview what we're going to be doing in October, a new series we're going to be starting called Immerse Beginnings. Those of you who are here back in the spring, we did something called Immerse Messiah, and we together as a congregation read through the New Testament. And we used the Immerse Bible experience, which is a slightly different format. It's a special Bible. It removes the chapters and verses and takes out some of those things to allow us to read it in a different way. We're going to be doing the same thing with a portion of the Old Testament. We're not going to be doing the entire Old Testament. We're going to be doing a portion of the Old Testament. We're going to be doing the first 5 books of the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And over an 8-week period, kind of same thing. You'll have an Immerse Bible. You get a chance to read through that without the chapters and verses. But as an extra bonus, something I'm really excited about this time, we're going to be doing it in conjunction with some other churches that are in the area. And so I'm a part of a prayer group that meets twice a month on Thursdays with some pastors from Muskegon. One of them, many of you know, Pastor Melvin Burns. He's come a number of times and preached with us here. He's pastor of one of those churches, Charles Hildreth, as well as Jared Ryder and James Harmon. And so these 5 pastors, 5 of us, our 5 churches are all going to begin and do it together at the same time. And that means 2 things. One is we'll have an opportunity. We're going to try and set up some of the Bible studies, some of the book studies as you're going through this to be with some of those other churches. So that you might be able to participate with some different folks in different congregations and experience with them what it's like to read through. Second thing is, 2 times during that 8-week period of preaching through this, we're going to kind of do some pulpit swapping around. And so there'll be 2 weeks where you'll get to hear from some other pastors and kind of their perspective on it, as well as I'll be at another congregation sharing how I see that. And it's just a great opportunity for us to participate and go through that. So I'm excited about what that's going to look like. But that will be beginning. We'll start our readings at the end of September so that the first sermon will be the first Sunday in October. And you'll get, over the next few weeks, you'll get more opportunity to hear about this. We'll make sure the books are distributed. And that, when I said earlier during our announcements, we'll have some additional studies starting up. That's what I was referring to. We're still working out some of the details of what that will look like. But that's all come when we finish up the book of Revelation. But for now, we're still in the book of Revelation. And so this book of Revelation is a call to follow Jesus. It's what I've titled the series, Following the Lamb. It's a call to overcome. And that's one of the key phrases that appears early on, is that the book of Revelation isn't written, I don't think, primarily to give us a roadmap to the future, but instead to unveil the current reality so we can understand what it looks like to follow Jesus. And it's a call to overcome persecution, but more importantly, to overcome the temptation to compromise. That all around us in the world, there are temptations to leave the path of Jesus, to give our allegiance to something other than Jesus. And throughout the book of Revelation, those alternatives have been given different names. They have been called Babylon. We've had 2 beasts, a beast from the sea and a beast from the land. We've also had the dragon, which was also known as the serpent or the devil or the Satan. And so these different figures are all ones that represent the forces, the powers in the world that are attempting to seduce us. They can represent political empire and power. They can represent the mixing of religion and power. They can represent the seduction of wealth and all the temptations of the world that call us to give our allegiance to something other than Jesus, to do something other than follow the way of the Lamb. And so the book of Revelation is helping us to see the reality of those things so we can avoid them. But the second thing the book of Revelation is doing is telling us that God is not leaving us alone in this process. That in the midst of all that, God is in the process of destroying, of making the world right. I said at the beginning that we're going to be looking at this new heaven and new earth in chapters 21 and 22, this future state where there will be no more death, no more crying, no more mourning, no more tears. We'll be river of life where we'll be constantly in the presence of God. But in order for that to happen, God has to eradicate evil in the world. He has to cleanse creation so that we can enjoy this new creation. And so he's been doing that through, we've been seeing what that looks like through the book of Revelation. There's been a series of judgments and it's been building, escalating as the book goes through. So near the end of the book, chapter 17 and 18, we come to the destruction of Babylon. Babylon, which is represented alternatively as a woman or as a city, this power of seduction, a call to primarily power and wealth and the seduction of that and the way it turns people from the way of Jesus. And it describes God destroying that. And then in chapter 19, there's this picture of Jesus on a white horse and he comes and simply with the word of his mouth, and we sang that hymn, ancient hymn from Martin Luther, written 500 plus years ago. And it talked about that. It says, what? Though the world is filled with devils, and then it says what? One little word shall fell him. And that's the description in the book of Revelation. There's many times where there's these gatherings for giant battles, but there's never a battle. It's just done by the power of Jesus. And so at the end of chapter 19, it happens. And then we come into chapter 20 and we're dealing with the last of the enemies, which is the dragon or the devil, the Satan or Satan. And so we're coming to that. So last week, we started chapter 20. And it brought us into this thing. And the way I understand the book of Revelation is it's kind of this repeating cycles. I've used a couple different analogies. It's like an instant replay. We're seeing the same thing over and over again from different angles. Or another analogy I used was it's like a swing. And you're a child on a swing and you're swinging. And each time you're kind of building an energy. So we go through and we come to near the end. And we're not quite at the end. And then we come a little closer. And now we're finally at that moment where we're at the big peak of the swing. And we're coming near the end. And so we have at the beginning of chapter 20, it talks about an angel coming down and binding Satan, putting him in chains, and then throwing him in the abyss. And so my understanding is that what this is describing, and this is what happened in the Christ event, we could call it, in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, that in the coming of Jesus, he binds Satan, he reduces his power. He doesn't eradicate him, because something that's bound, and I use the illustration of a dog and a chain, still has power. It can still hurt you if you come within the circle of the chain. But it's limited in its power. And so in the same way, the Satan is bound and limited in its power. And so this is kind of the language used in other places in the New Testament. There's in chapter 12, there's a picture of the dragon being thrown down. Chapter 12 of Revelation. In the Gospels, the stories of Jesus, it talks, he uses that language of binding the strong man. Paul, one of the writers in the New Testament, talks about Jesus in his death on the cross, disarming the principalities and powers. So all these are pictures together of saying this 1,000-year period is a representation of what God does to bind or limit the power of Satan for 1,000 years. And the 1,000 years I describe as, or I understand as the time between the coming of Jesus, between the cross and between now. It's the age of the church. And so we can think, well, a couple different other pictures we could use is we can think of at this point in time, so we're saying, wait a minute, but Satan's still doing things. The beast and the powers are still at work. And a couple different ways to understand is we say they're beaten, but the final victory hasn't come. And so one of the most famous metaphors used is by a theologian named Oscar Coleman. And Oscar Coleman describes it like D-Day. And so if you're a history buff, remember back in World War II, the U.S. and Britain and France and the Allied powers are fighting against Nazi Germany. And one of the significant events in World War II was D-Day, June 6, 1944. The Allied forces had landed on these 5 beaches in France. And in some sense, the war is over. Once the Allies have a foothold in France, for all intents and purposes, in some sense, the war is over. But there's still another year of fighting left after that. But anyone looking at that situation looks and said, the Nazis, they haven't defeated. Now that the Allies have a foothold in France, the end is certain. We know where this war is going. And so that's one picture. He uses it in the same way that Jesus comes and his death on the cross is D-Day. It's done. There's still battles. There's still kind of cleanup and mop-up operations, but we know where the battle is headed. Or we could use a different metaphor. If you're not a history buff, is a chess picture. Picture the game of chess, and Robert Mulholland uses this one. He says, and it's been a long time since I played much chess, But there are people, when you play chess, one of the things is many people can see multiple steps ahead, moves ahead. They can look, and you're playing a chess, a grandmaster in chess. They can see the game. And oftentimes what can happen in a game is a grandmaster can make a move. There might be 20 or 30 moves left in the game, but there will be a checkmate at the end. They're kind of this setting move that no matter what the other player does, they will lose the game. And this is in some sense what happens at Jesus' death on the cross is that mating move. It's that move. The game's not over. It's not checkmate yet. But there is nothing the other player can do that won't result in loss. And so Jesus, in his death on the cross, is that move that God makes and says, this game is over. There's still moves to be played out, but we're leading to the end. And so we have this 1,000-year picture, which I call the age of the church, and it's filled with symbols and thrones and numbers and binding. And so that brings us to today. All right, so we've kind of built up to today, and we've got Satan has been thrown in, chained and thrown in the abyss. And then we get two parts to today's reading. One, there's the judgment of Satan. And then the second part is the white throne in the book. So we're going to focus mainly on the second, but I want to look briefly at that first one. Is to think about what happens, because there's something strange that happens. And that's in verse 7, when it says, when the 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from his prison. And he will go out to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, and to gather them for battle in number. And they are like the sand on the seashore. So it's a strange thing. So what happens? So God has taken Jesus, or God has taken Satan, bound him, put him in the abyss. And then at the end, he just decides to let him go for a little while. And one scholar like kind of says, nobody knows what to do with this. And he's exaggerating a little bit, but why in the world would Satan be released at the end? And there are struggles, and there are different systems trying to understand this, but none really completely make sense to me. So if we take, as I took it, 1,000 years as the symbol of the church age, so from Jesus, from the death of Jesus to his second coming, what's the problem? How does this make sense? Because if the 1,000 years ends when Jesus returns, the return of Jesus is the final judgment. So where does the release of Satan and this gathering of enemies come in? So you say, well, that doesn't quite make sense. But if we take the 1,000 years as a literal 1,000 years of reign, where 19 and 20 come together, where Jesus comes on a white horse, he sets up an earthly kingdom and he's reigning on a throne. And at the end of 19, it says all the people gathered with the beast are destroyed. And then he sets up a 1,000-year reign. We have this bizarre thing where Jesus is reigning on earth for 1,000 years with all of his saints. And then all of a sudden at the end, he lets Satan out of prison. And somehow Satan is able to gather from the earth a bunch of enemies, an army. Where in the world did these armies come from if they were all destroyed at the end of chapter 19? Where in the world did these armies come from if Jesus has been physically reigning on the earth for 1,000 years? So if we kind of go, I don't know. I'm going to offer you just quickly one idea that a scholar named Shane Wood has proposed. And we're going to go through that. And then we're going to focus on keeping the main thing the main thing. And what Shane Wood has proposed is this. He notices a couple things in the text. He might just notice that back in early in chapter 20, Satan, it says, is put in chains and then thrown in the abyss. But in verse 7, it simply says Satan is released. Never says he's taken out of the chains. And then what Wood does is he says, back in the Roman days, there was something that was very common. And this was well known, was that when the Roman emperors, when the generals would go off and fight a battle, and they would win a battle, they would come back and they would hold a triumphal procession. And what it would look like is this. They would go off, they would fight a war. And when they would defeat the enemy, they wouldn't necessarily kill all the enemy prisoners. Many of them they would bring back, particularly if they could capture the enemy general. And they would bring them back in chains to Rome. And then they would have this grand parade, a triumphal procession in which they would march the enemy soldiers and often carrying, and then people carrying the enemy's weapons. Sometimes they would force the enemy soldiers to reenact the battles in which they were defeated, fighting against each other and killing each other. And at the end of the triumphal procession, the very last thing in the procession, there would be two things. There would be the enemy general, the enemy leader, bound in chains, walking before the quadrigo, which was this four-horse chariot, these white, four white horses pulling a chariot on which the Roman emperor rode. So you have this picture that was found all over the ancient world. People in the days of Jesus or days of John the Revelator would know about this story. They would have seen it happen. They would see it displayed on murals all across Rome, these pictures of this thing. And notice what's at the end of the procession is the enemy general in chains marching in front of the Roman emperor. And they would have this grand procession through Rome. They would bring the enemy general to the temple of Jupiter where they would execute him. And so what Shane Wood proposes is this is what we're seeing in Revelation 27 through 9 is God's triumphal procession. The Satan is bound. He doesn't do anything. He marches him in chains. The battle is simply a reminder of the battle that's happened before. But the most important part, even if you take Shane Wood's ideas and completely throw that out, even if you disagree, like, I don't know about why he's released and how it's released, most important thing is verse 10. 7 through 9 may be a little unclear. We might be a little muddy on it instead. But verse 10, and the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet had been thrown. They will be tormented day and night forever. So no matter how you understand this release of Satan and how this works in with the 1,000 years, the point is, what's the final destiny? That Satan is defeated, that he's thrown into the lake of fire. So we've had the defeat and the judgment of Babylon. We've had the beast defeated. We've had the devil defeated, all doomed and destroyed, thrown in the lake of fire, this different imagery. And so now we come to the next set of imagery. And one of the things I want us to notice, and I give you an insert, and I don't. Sometimes you can look at it, sometimes you don't, doesn't matter to me. But in there, we realize that the imagery from verses 11 through 15 come through all out the Bible. John isn't simply drawing these things, but he's drawing on the images, the pictures he knows to describe things. So Daniel chapter 7, Daniel chapter 12, places in the New Testament, earlier in the book of Revelation, all these pictures that come together of someone on a white throne, of a judgment, of books being opened, of the second death, of all these things go together. So let's kind of take a look at this picture. Chapter 20, verse 11. There I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. The earth and the heavens fled from his presence and there was no place for them. So we have a great white throne and someone seated on it. Anyone want to take a guess? Who's on the throne? Jesus? God? I mean, wait, there's different images of that, but is it the devil? Is it the beast? Is it people? No, it's God and potentially Jesus. There's kind of these crossings that go over, or, you know, God and the Lamb sitting on the throne. So there's this Lamb, and where are we? We're in heaven. So there's a throne and a great white throne. And so this picture of purity, of power sitting there. And then it says the earth and heaven fled. And again, we're using pictures because you're trying to picture what does this look like. So a throne appears and like the earth grows legs and runs away. No, what is it saying that it's a sense of the old order is passing away. Something new has happened. And what exists now doesn't have a place in it. The old order passes away. It flees from his presence because there was no place for them. God is making something new, so the old has no room. There's no place for the old. So from here, I want to just kind of look at the big picture of it. So we have the dead, the great and small, standing before the throne. And I think the focus is primarily on the unbelievers. And we'll see why in a minute. I think in the end, ultimately, everyone stands before God, but the focus in these particular verses is on those who have not given their lives to Jesus. And I think this for a couple reasons. One is kind of the nature of what we've been doing. If we've dealt with the beasts, we've dealt with Babylon, we've dealt with the dragon, and now who is God dealing with in some sense, for lack of a better language? The people who have given allegiance to the beast. And so we've seen the fate of Babylon, the fate of the beast, the fate of the dragon. Now we're seeing what's the fate of those who have worshiped the beast? Those who have, in the words of John, taken the mark of the beast. Or the other reason I think it's primarily about unbelievers is this, chapter 20, verse 13. The sea gave up the dead that were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them, and each person was judged according to what they had done. So we have something interesting going on. One is, We have just been told, what did the earth and the heaven do in the presence of the throne? Ran away, right? But now we have a sea. So where did the world did the sea come from? Are we talking about the literal physical sea? Probably not. Throughout the book of Revelation, the sea has represented the forces of chaos, the forces of evil, and then we have death and Hades. And so if the sea represents the force of chaos, we have the sea giving up the dead in them, which would be the evil forces. And then we have Hades. There's so many little rabbit trails in these passages, it's hard to kind of make a way through them. But hopefully you can stick with me for just a minute. So Hades, one of the things we need to clarify, Hades and hell, two different things. Two very different things. Hades in the Old Testament, so the time before Jesus in the writing, is what we'd call the place of the dead, the abode of the dead. So when someone died, they went to Hades. And there were two kind of compartments in Hades. There was the compartment for the righteous and the compartment for the unrighteous. So there's these two places when you die, you go there, waiting the final judgment, waiting the final resurrection. Now, so we've got, say, the righteous dead and the unrighteous dead in Hades. Jesus comes, dies on the cross, he's resurrected. At that moment, there's a change in Hades, and those who are the righteous dead go to be in the presence of God, still without body, but a spiritual resurrection, which has taken place throughout the book of Revelation, talked about the souls gathered around the throne. So now Hades, if the righteous dead after the resurrection go to be with God, who's left in Hades? The unrighteous. So when John says that death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them, the only dead left in Hades are the unrighteous. And then we have some books being opened. And books are a picture, again, a symbol of I don't expect that when we come to the last days that we're going to see this giant library stack of books. And like angels and God paging through them and saying, okay, look, friends and friends and FR, you know, I mean, looking and finding out about my deeds. It's a picture of what? When something is in a book, what does that tell you about that thing? It's written down, right? It's permanent. It's remembered. And so when books are opened, which contain what? What people had done. It says that what we do is recorded. It's permanent. We like to forget about the things we've done. I mean, I know in my own life, as I look back on my life, there are things that I've done I just like to forget about. There are things that have been done to me I'd like to forget. I'd like to pretend I didn't do those things. But what this judgment scene is saying is, we may want to forget about them. We may actually even forget about them, because there are probably things not probably. I can say with certainty, there are things that I have done that were wrong that I've just forgotten I did. I mean, they just happened. But the point of the books is they haven't been forgotten by God. And so these deeds are recorded. And the other thing it says is they're judged according to what? By the things they have done. And so the important thing is that the things we do matter. Now, does that mean that our salvation comes by our deeds? No. But if you read the book of Revelation, if you read numerous passages in the New Testament, there's a suggestion that what we do still matters. The things we do matter. But more significantly, we have a big stack of books of the deeds, but there's another book. And what's that other book? The book of life. Or in other places, it's known as the book of the Lamb. And so we have these two. So we have the Lamb's book. It says, anyone whose name was not found written in the book of life or the Lamb's book of life was thrown into the lake of fire. So the implication is, name's not in the Lamb's book of life, thrown into the lake of fire. Implication is what? If your name is written in the Lamb's book of life, not thrown in the lake of fire. I mean, it doesn't say that specifically, but that's the point, right? And in fact, we're going to find out in chapters 21 and 22, what happens to those people whose names are written in the book of life? But what else gets thrown in the lake of fire here? Yeah, but actually something like Satan was earlier, right? But it says, then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. So, I mean, we kind of maybe understand, okay, there's a spiritual being thrown, but death, I mean, was there like a giant cat? I mean, what does it look like to throw death into a lake of fire? What does it look like to throw Hades, this spiritual realm, into a lake of fire? And this is where it's important, when we're reading the book of Revelation, to understand we're working with symbols. We're working with pictures, and we need to let the symbols breathe, so to speak. We need to let the symbols speak and not try and make them say everything, but to understand what they're pointing to. And what are they pointing to? How do you throw death? How do you throw Hades in the lake of fire? The point is what? What's happening to death in Hades? They're being destroyed. And the reason I use even that language, so again, different pictures. We need to let the symbol speak. Isaiah chapter 25. I didn't put this one on your sheet, but Isaiah chapter 25, verses 7 and 8. Speaking about God, it says, on this mountain, he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. So does God swallow death or does he throw it in a lake of fire? The point is, it's a picture, it's a symbol. And what John is pointing to, and so we need to sometimes look beyond a symbol, look beyond a picture, let the symbol speak. The point is what? Death is no more, which is what chapter 21, verse 4 says. He will wipe away every tear. There will be no more death. In other words, this picture that John says, death and Hades are thrown in the lake of fire. What he's telling us is what? They don't exist anymore. We don't need to worry about them anymore. Whether God swallowed them or they're in a lake of fire. So there are different pictures used to represent different things. And so sometimes we try and put too much in the pictures, but we have to look beyond the picture, beyond the symbol and say, what's it pointing to? What's the reality that it's pointing to? And the reality it's pointing to is death and Hades are no more. The death is gone. So now we come in and we kind of say, what do we do with all this? So we have this picture, we have a judgment scene, we have Satan being judged. Then we have this scene where people are brought together before God. There's this another resurrection, or they're in some sense brought to life. They're brought out of death and Hades and out of the sea, and they stand before God and books are open and judged by their deeds. And if your book name's not in the Lamb's Book of Life, you're cast into the fire. If your name is in the Lamb's Book of Life, you spend eternity with God. And so there are these two choices. So I want to give five kind of things that we can take away from this. One is, and this is important, ours is not to decide who is in and who is out. Okay? You can be certain of your own salvation. You can have this confidence of, I have given my life to Jesus, I have given my allegiance to him, and my name is in the book of life. But we need to be really, really careful about deciding about other people and whether or not their name is in the book of life. Now, we may wonder, we may question, and if we question, our goal then should be to say, let me tell you about Jesus. Let me introduce you to the Lamb. Let me introduce you to the one so that your name can be written in the book of life. But it's not ours to look and say, well, obviously, I know where that person went. No, we don't. We don't know that, and so we need to be really, really careful. It never says we get to decide who goes where. Who decides the final destination of people? God and God alone. So let's be really, really careful about deciding who is in and who is out. Second thing is, I think we need to be careful about wanting to see others punished. There is a cry for justice. But for the idea, sometimes we get a temptation. We see someone, maybe we hear about something. It's like, oh, I hope that person goes. No. That should never be our approach to someone. I mean, we can be bothered by someone. We can cry out to God for justice and let God deal with it. But we need to be really careful, really, really careful about wanting to see others punished and suffer, wanting to see others die, wanting to see others experience the fate of judgment. Because that can warp and change our hearts in horrible ways. So we need to be careful about what we do and how we use this passage. And we're careful not to be rejoicing. Well, I'm glad I know where that person went. I'm so glad now. Third thing is this. There are lots of details and symbols and pictures here. And we can disagree on those. And that's what I've invited you. You don't have to agree with all of my interpretation. You don't have to agree with people I've quoted. You can have different ways of understanding it. But what we should agree on is what's clear. And what's clear to me from this passage and every different commentator from all different stripes I've read is there is a final judgment. And that either the final judgment results in one of two things, either life eternal in the new heaven and new earth, or what John calls the lake of fire, or the second death. Those are the two options. So though we might disagree on what exactly is the nature of Babylon and who's the beast and what's the dragon and how does the thousand years work and what is this picture talking about and what about the four horsemen? All those things come together, but at the end, there's this image that is consistent enough through the Bible that we can agree on it, that in the end, that at some point in the future, there will be a final judgment. And God will be the judge. And there will be two choices. There will be those whose name are in the book of life or in the Lamb's book of life and those who aren't. And those who are in the Lamb's book of life will spend eternity in the new heaven and the new earth with God. And those who don't are cast into the lake of fire, who experience the second death, who experience this, the consequences as John has pictured them here and using these different images and pictures. Number four. What's the difference? Actually, I only did four. I told you five. Bonus. I'm cutting it short. Four takeaways from it. Fourth one is this. Fourth and final one is this. So if there is a final judgment and the destiny, the outcome of that final judgment depends on whether or not your name is in the Lamb's book of life, then it's up to us to make that decision. It's up to us to make that decision. And it's about whether or not our name is in that book. And our name is in that book based on our relationship to God. Based on, I've used different language for it. I like the terminology of allegiance. We've given our allegiance to Jesus. We've pledged our faith, our trust in him, and follow him with all our heart. You might use the expression of, we've given our faith to Jesus. We've put our faith, we've put our trust in him. You've given your heart to Jesus. You've asked him into your life. Lots of different language. And if you've been around church, you've probably heard those different ones. The point is this. You've said at some point that there will be a final judgment. You've said at some point that the only way my hope, my only hope, as the Heidelberg Catechism, my only hope in life and death is this, is Jesus. What is my hope in life and death? It's Jesus. And that's what you said, that's the Lamb's book of life. There's not a magical phrase you say. It doesn't mean you have to have walked down a church aisle and said a particular prayer. It doesn't mean you have had to be able to remember a date and a time, be able to say, well, this was the moment. But what it does mean is that at some point you've decided, I'm going to give my life to Jesus. I'm going to follow him. I'm going to put my trust in him and not in myself. I'm going to give my allegiance to Jesus and not to the beasts and to the Satan. I'm going to give my allegiance, my trust in Jesus. And when we do, our name is written in the Lamb's book of life. Or we could say that our name is written in the citizen registry. So in ancient Rome, there was a book kept of the citizens of Rome. And you could go and you could review this book. And if your name was in the citizen registry of Rome, you were entitled to all the rights and privileges of being a citizen of Rome. But if they weren't, then you weren't entitled to those rights. And so in the same way, when our name is written in the Lamb's book of life, we're entitled to all the rights and privileges of being a citizen of heaven, a citizen of God's city, a citizen of the new Jerusalem, a citizen of this picture. And so the invitation then is, and it's always an open invitation until the final judgment, to say, will you give your life to Jesus? Will you put your trust in him? Will you give him your allegiance? And the call is to say, this is the opportunity. If you long to experience life and life eternal, life in this life, life that's flourishing and full of life, a life free from the power of sin and death, then you give your life to Jesus. And so that's the invitation from him. So while we take this strange and bizarre picture of the book of Revelation, what it points us to is this, that we all have a choice to make. Whether we're going to give our allegiance to the Lamb, whether we're going to give our allegiance to Jesus, whether we're going to give our faith, our trust, our life, or we're going to give it to something else. If we give it to something else, the consequence is judgment. It's the lake of fire. It's the second death. If we give it to Jesus, it's life and life eternal. And none of us can make the choice for you. But we're called to make that choice. And part of it is the incredible gift, the grace that God gives us that opportunity. Because if he were to simply have the book of deeds, the things we had all done, we would all fall short. But the story of the Bible is there is another book. A book written in grace. A book that's about a gift, the gift of free life offered to us. So may you experience, may you choose the life offered by the Lamb, the one who was slain. Amen.